And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and it's my pleasure to welcome back the Honorable Martin Clark today. He's a circuit court judge from the Commonwealth of Virginia, but today we'll only be talking about the law as it is in the confines of his fourth novel, The Jezebel Remedy, which is published by Knopf. Martin, it's been 7 years since your last novel, The Legal Limit, was published, so what's been keeping you busy?
Well, I do have a day job. I'm a circuit court judge. But in my own defense, a couple things I'll tell you. Knopf held the book for almost a year and a half, and I don't think that's particularly uncommon. It seems to be about 9 months to a year seems to be the standard. But I think they had a sense it would be a good summer book, so they held it for a little longer than normal. And the other thing, my father was sick during this time, and I did not write for a year. It's the first time I hadn't written since I was in college almost. And I spent about a year with him, taking care of him. I decided that, one, I just wasn't in the mood to write, and two, obviously, that was sort of bleeding into what I was doing and coloring my perspective. So, now, do you feel bad now for asking the question?
No, not yet.
So that took about a year out. Then they held it for a year and a half. So it was a little slower than normal, but not that much when you subtract the time I wasn't writing.
What did it feel like when you got back to writing?
Good, because I enjoy it. People always ask, why do you write? Do you like writing? And yeah, I do. That's why I do it. Some people enjoy stamp collecting. Some people enjoy sports, playing golf. I like doing it. So it was really good to get back. And I bet most writers tell you this. I don't like the editing process. It is fun to sit down. It's fun to write. It's fun to create things. It is tedious, at least for me, especially working with a great editor like Gary Fiskejohn, to go through all the tiny little edits and commas and minuscule questions. So writing is fun. It was good to get back to it.
It's about 50-50. I have some people that just hate the revision process and some of them that just love it.
It's not so much the revision process for me. That's almost refreshing. Working with a good editor, there are things in a 400- or 500-page manuscript that I will write again and again, and I know they're still not good. And you paper over them and you do the best you can, but you know they're not really what they should be. And getting the fix back for that is almost a relief. It's sort of the copy edit, all these tiny, small angels on pinheads things that I just hate doing.
Now, how easy is it for you to let go of the book once all that's done?
Really easy. Many Aspects of Mobile Home Living, my first novel, was just maybe 5 to 6 months ago, recorded the audio. I'm so old, I still call them books on tape. I had completely forgotten it. Listening to it was like almost listening to it for the first time. Now, I could anticipate a few of the lines, but once I write them and put them behind me, I don't look back at all.
A friend once told me that he wished he would have been an English major when he went to law school because there's so much writing involved.
I'll tell you what, the smartest people in law school are the math majors, at least in my class. I don't know if that holds true across the board. I don't
know. Well, logic and math.
Exactly. Exactly. You're very analytical. I was a Latin major. That did me no good in law school. English majors, I would guess. I don't know if there's any particular major that will treat you that well in law school, but several of my friends were math majors, and they were the best students we had.
Now let's jump into The Jezebel Remedy. And Jill and Lisa Stone are married. They're also law partners, and it's been 20 years. You think all that time together is really a wise thing?
Well, see, my wife and I have been married 10 years, and it's still spectacular. Let me get that out of the way.
But working together.
It would have to be hard, don't you think? I cannot imagine working with my spouse. But I know people who do it. And not only in law, but I know people who do it in a number of contexts, and they seem happy enough with it. Interestingly enough, a lot of bookstore owners seem to work with a spouse. I'm thinking of Park Road Books. They helped me with my kickoff for this book in Patrick County in Stewart, where I live. And Sally and Fraser have been together for quite a long time. I think he has a job outside of the store now, but it would be difficult for me. It really would be.
So you're in Stewart County, Virginia, and this book is set in Henry County, Virginia. Is it your chance to make fun of Henry County a little bit?
Technically, I'm in Patrick County, and Stewart is a county seat.
Uh-huh.
And Henry County, yes, it is, a little bit. Let me just say
Stuart, Patrick, Henry, what? Patrick Henry, Patrick being in Henry County?
We have Patrick County, which is adjacent to Henry County, and there you go, Patrick Henry. And the county seat of Patrick, where I live, is Stuart, Virginia, named after Jeb Stuart, the Civil War general. But there's always been a little bit of rivalry, and Henry County at one point, and that's part of the book, that's part of the backdrop. Henry County was an amazing industrial spot. Bassett Furniture was there. And I didn't realize this until recently, but Bassett Furniture was the largest producer of wood frame furniture in the world. You had all the textile plants. You had Toltex. You had Fieldcrest. And then you had American Furniture. And it was just a real go-go place. And that produced some people, not everyone, but a certain class of people who looked down their noses at the Simpletons and Rubes up the road in Patrick County. That has changed a bit. Patrick County is still very stable economically. It's not great. But Henry County was eviscerated by the recession. All those jobs are gone. And that's part of the interest I had in the book, and that's how the book starts. With that as a backdrop, the abandoned DuPont plant, the main street with stores that are closed and doodad emporiums, I call them, without even proper signage, traffic lights that are not working. It's a bit of a ghost town there now.
Because you are down on the North Carolina border, and North Carolina is famous for its furniture.
Exactly. We're right on the Virginia-North Carolina border. My friend Beth Macy, she doesn't need it, but I'll give her a plug, and I don't know if you've heard of the book. It's called Factory Man. It was a big, big book, and it's nonfiction. And it's about the Bassett family, and it's about Henry County and its decline. And I told Beth that she beat me to the punch. And the other part that's obvious is that sets the stage, sets the background. Those are the atmospherics for the little bit of boredom that Lisa Stone is feeling, both with her job and her marriage. That decline is mirrored in her personal life.
Lisa has really kind of grown tired of the quirks that Joe has. The little things that make him Joe are starting to wear on her nerves. What are some of the things that irritate her so?
My favorite, he names their dog. Their dog is Black, and they've had him for a long time, and he names the dog Brownie, which is clever, I think, at the beginning. And then he just wears it out. He absolutely wears that out. And this comes into play later in the book, but he is very, very technical, and he is very, very precise. So it's a mom-and-pop law practice or a husband-and-wife law practice, just the two of them. And Joe insists on doing everything precisely according to form. So it drives her crazy. He will have a stockholders meeting, and it's just the two of them. And it will be a stockholders meeting. Should we buy a new computer? Should we get new gutters? Should we fix the roof? And it absolutely drives her crazy.
It adheres to Robert's rules of order when it's just
the
two
of them. He really does, yeah. I always like coming because you've always read the book. So thank you, by the way, for doing that. So those are my favorite, too. But there's a whole list at the beginning of the novel.
But it does seem that he doesn't quite get that part of wit is kind of the appearance of spontaneity in it. And to use those same jokes of, you know, good job, Brownie, or what's...
Yeah, exactly.
Over and over and over again, that, you know, repetition doesn't often make for great comedy.
And it really does just drive her crazy. And he's aware of it, too. That's the other part of the book. He knows that. He's not adult. He understands that it's crucifying her last nerve, to use the line from the book. But he does it anyway because he still thinks it's funny. And as he says, part of my charm. And if I quit doing it, it wouldn't be me and you would miss it. And she says, I'm willing to take that chance.
But what makes this even worse is that he doesn't have any other major flaws. That, you know, if he were kind of a jerk in some way, you could concentrate on, you know, if he were, you know, flirting with other women, doing stuff like that, she could concentrate on those real tangible flaws. But no, he's a good guy. He's honorable. He loves her very much. So it's just these little things. And she feels kind of frustrated that he's just irritating in these small ways.
He's very steady. And it's interesting, I mean, obviously, as we sit down here, you and I haven't discussed this book at all. I just walked into your studio. But some of my early readers, especially some women, did not find him appealing and did not see him as steady and reliable and his many strengths. He has a lot of strengths. I mean, there's no need for me to sit here and list them. But as you go through, you learn this about him and you learn that about him. And he has a lot of strengths and a lot of assets. He's a good lawyer. He's honest. He is steadfast in terms of the relationship, and he's devoted to his wife. But many of my early readers, I shouldn't say many, but several, both men and women, thought he was a tool. And I never did. That's not the character I tried to write. So I'm glad he impressed you as a good person. He's not spectacular. He's not flashy. There's nothing particularly colorful about him. But he is a good man with a lot of positive assets. And so when she becomes restless, it plagues her because she keeps telling herself, I really should be content with my husband because I have a good husband.
So when your early readers are saying that he's not all that appealing, do you go back and try to retool him in some way to impress that on us?
Yes. Yes, I did. As much as you can and not lose what I'm doing. And I think maybe at the beginning, you still may have that impression, depending on how you see him and your perspective as a reader. But as it goes through, and one of the scenes that I wrote later is his scene with the, I can't remember, is it a 22, 38, with a handgun on the tarmac. And his wife says, you know, geez, I am glad I'm married to this guy now. He's got the goods. He's the real deal. He is physical and he can take care of us. He may have a lot of quirks, but that counts for a lot. And that was a late ad scene to sort of balance him out and give him a little more metaphorical muscle.
Now, she's started to flirt around a bit.
Well, not a bit. She's flirting.
But it starts off as flirting with another lawyer from another town named Brett Brooks. And I don't know if you can trust anyone with an alliterative name.
Yeah. Well, the middle, it's Brett Lee Brooks. So that breaks it up just a little bit.
But it's really uncomfortable reading, watching her go down this path of flirtation that leads to a little bit more. And knowing that this is a really terrible decision she's making. It's just like watching a car wreck in slow motion.
You sent me, and this is not my writing style, but it is a little bit with this book. Some time ago, you sent me an interview you had done with Larry Brown. And it's no secret, Larry is my favorite writer. And in that interview, and again, I have a framework, I have the story in my head, but it was something that was really interesting Larry said. He said, I create really good characters, and then I load them up with problems, and I see what happens. And that's exactly what this is. You create an interesting character, you give her a problem, and you watch what happens, and it will make you uncomfortable. It should.
So were Joe and Lisa the first part of the book, or was the plot the thing that came to you?
The plot is always with me, the story. And I cannot start until I have it from alpha to omega. So I have the whole plot arc in my head. Then I write the book, and this may have changed 10% from where I started. There's a scene in a dentist's office, and that was a little more involved, and it was a little more, there was some more trickery in that, and it was a little more in depth. But other than that, it's as it was in my head.
While she's kind of torturing over this decision to flirt with Brett and do more, she has a friend named MJ.
Yeah.
Who is a bundle of fire. She's a self-made millionaire businesswoman. She's very loyal, but she gives her opinions, too, to Lisa.
MJ is my favorite sidekick ever. It may sort of demean her to call her a sidekick. She is based on, we have a friend, and her name is Michelle. And it's interesting when you write, when you use a person you know as a takeoff. And Michelle is a smart, articulate, successful woman. And I had to say, you understand this isn't you. You understand I am not writing your biography. But Michelle got her start as a woman selling heavy equipment. She went from the bottom rung and moved through the hierarchy until she is, and I don't know what her job is now, but it basically involves flying all around the world and managing hundreds, if not thousands, of people, large accounts. She's become incredibly successful. But that was an interesting, for me at least, this woman who became successful in a completely male-dominated industry. And she is out in the beginning making a living selling bobcats and attachments and going into construction sites and doing well. And so that's the beginning of MJ.
Talk about her loyalty and
she's,
with Lisa.
She's fiercely loyal to Lisa. But she also understands, it's interesting that she's not a lawyer, but she may have a better sense of how the world works than the lawyer. And maybe because she herself, MJ, is constantly involved in the business world, lawsuits, all sorts of legal mischief, she may have a better sort of real politic view of the world than her friend. But she says, I just don't have any faith in the system. And if you want me to lie for you, just give me the script. If I need to do this to help you, once they get into a jam and all the legal machinations begin, if you need help, I'll lie for you.
And with that, I had to disagree with MJ on a couple of things. In line and furtherance of justice, sure, no problem. Lying to...
to help your best friend cover an affair?
Yeah, I got a problem with that.
Well, she says that's what we do. She said that's her line. She says that's part of my best friend duties. That's what we do. And of course, later on, she says, well, I told you not to do it. And Lisa says, no, you didn't. You let me use your cell phone as part of the cover. I think there's a difference, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, if you had a friend and you knew he or she were doing something improper and let's say specifically a marital indiscretion, would you report them? Would you feel obligated to tell the spouse? That's one issue. The other issue is, would you actively participate in it? And I think that's your issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you keep your mouth shut. That's between them two.
Right.
But you don't help them.
Okay. Well, she did. I mean, that's quite a loyal friend.
Now, there is one professional thing that really drives Lisa nuts about Joe, and it's his indulging of a local eccentric named Letty Van Zandt.
Letty Van Zandt, when this book went to edit, most of the vignettes, I don't want to call them set pieces because that makes him seem sort of static and stuck in, but there are several vignettes about Letty or involving Letty. And almost all of them spring from or have a basis in fact. The carving knife at a convenience store, that happened. One of the stories that was in the early version that got cut. Have you ever seen shoes or boots on a power line? They're thrown up, tied together. I understand in some regions it has to do with marking gang territory. In Patrick County, where we live, it has nothing to do with that. But you see it from time to time. I think probably it's a prank. I'm not sure how work boots or tennis shoes or a pair of wingtips end up tied together and dangling from a power line. In the book, Letty, and this will give folks a sense of her personality, has stopped her station wagon. It has a .22 rifle and is trying to shoot them down because she wants them because they look like really, really good quality boots. That happened. That's a true story. Moreover, failing to shoot them down, she then calls the fire department and wants them to bring the bucket truck out so that they can help her get the shoes from the power line. That happened. Those are true stories. Those were cut from the manuscript because people, or especially my editor, said that just never happened. No one will believe that. That's just too eccentric. That's too much. That's pushing the boundary too far. So as eccentric and colorful as Letty is, she has been reined in a bit for the book.
I'll tell you a side story that'll be cut from the broadcast, but in 1991, it was the last Southwest Conference basketball tournament that Arkansas was a part of before they entered the Southeastern Conference. And a few of my buddies and I had gone down to see it, and there's an entertainment district in Dallas. And I'd gone off into a shop and came back out, and my friends were with this young woman who was very inebriated. And what had happened was her friends had tied her shoes together and thrown them over a power line. So she was barefoot at night in Dallas. And so she was begging for money so she could buy a new pair of shoes. And they asked her to perform for them by calling the Hogs. Do you know have you ever heard
Suey,
the Hogs?
Suey?
Woo Pig, Suey.
Okay.
And she was so inebriated, she couldn't quite get it right. And so she was saying to her, woo, piggy, 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 piggy.
Yeah. Well, see, you've seen it at least.
So oh, yeah.
You know. I mean, you know that people get there. And I think most of the time it probably is just somebody having a good time. You're asleep, you're drunk or something. Somebody takes your shoes and they toss them up on the power line.
But I've heard in some areas people do it to honor someone that's passed away.
I've never heard that. I've not heard that.
Line. Yeah. Now, I mean, she generates a lot of calls to 911. She is what we used to call in the business a frequent caller.
At one point in the novel, the head of the 911 center, after Letty is dead, is making a greatest hits compilation. That's how frequently she calls. And again, it's interesting you say that because you know that happens. There are people who will just, especially local morning chat shows in small towns, people call in, they meander, they have nothing to add, unless it's something that is just bizarre and Byzantine. And that's who Letty is. She wears out the morning talk show. She wears out the 911 center, and that's part of her personality.
They get a very troubling call, and they find out Letty has died. yes. and terrible circumstances.
Yes. And that's the kickoff of sort of the plot part of the book. I remember one time I was here and you asked me, what's the book about? The John Irving question.
I don't think I ever asked that question. I wouldn't ask anything that simple.
What's the book about? It's the worst question in the world. I like to say, I can tell you in 400 pages. I can't tell you in 40 words. But the plot part of this book that kicks off with Letty's death in a fire deals with the legal system, the system that we have that is essentially was created by men who believed in medicinal leeches and wore knickers and would have been scared to death of a microwave oven, would have thought it was haunted or it was some kind of witchcraft. And how does that ancient, antiquated system adapt to the scientific and forensic evidence that we have today? And the interesting part for me is jurors and people in general are so invested, so completely and absolutely invested in what I call the CSI marvels and that kind of evidence. And it carries such a payload in the court system. People also fail to understand that it can be manipulated pretty easily, and it's not quite as precise and exact as you might think. And so that's the getting off point for the plot part of the book, the fun part of the book. And we've already talked about sort of the personal part of the book, and that is, can you fix a marital mistake? Can you correct? Is there a Jezebel remedy? Can you fix something? If in good faith you come back to your spouse and say, I made an error, can it be fixed? Is there a Jezebel remedy? Is there a cure for a marital mistake? And of course, in this book, it's the nuclear one. It's the big one. It's not I burned something in the oven. It's a big one.
With Letty's passing, she has a son, Neil, who lives down in Atlanta. And he's odd, but he's not quite Letty odd.
He's odd in the sense that he is just not a very developed person. And at some point, and I don't remember where it is in the book, one of the characters says, you know, if you were raised by Letty Van Zandt, he's as lucky as functional that he is. And he's meek, but he's not eccentric. He's not crazy. He's just meek and shy.
But the problem is that they find out Letty has written a will recently, leaving everything to Joe, the lawyer, and not Neil, her son.
And Joe, and as we talked earlier, being Joe, and decides that he doesn't want to keep any of it because it would be wrong. And all he wants to do is pay her just debts, pay her expenses, get her buried, and then he will give everything to Neil. And he sets out to do that. And part of that would be the hoard of strays and cast-offs, the animals that she keeps.
Quite a menagerie.
Yes. And he says, we need to take care of that. You get that managed, and I will give you her estate. Well, at that point, her estate is a dilapidated mobile home, a couple acres of land, some ragtag furniture, all the dogs and cats that she has taken in to look after. So it's not as if he's giving a whole lot away at that point. And you can tell, by the way I say that there's more to come.
And he does ask the very pointed question, are you aware of anything else?
Lisa asked that question. Wow. She's the precise one. She is, and she scolds him for being so lackadaisical and so unprofessional. And she says, you know, Joe, would you not ask this question of any other client? And this is just because it's our business and because it's Letty, you need to ask that. And Neil, do you know of anything else? Is there anything else in the estate that you're aware of that we're giving up? And Neil says, no.
Joe and Lisa agree to take a couple of the animals. They take a pair of cats, little tuxedo cats,
yeah,
to patrol the barn at their property, and they've named them Poncho and Lefty, so that's the second time you've honored Towns Van Zandt in the book.
Good for you. Do you like that?
Yeah,
that's one of my favorite. And I played around with those names, and I don't think you could do better than Poncho and Lefty. And as usual, let me say, every book I have starts with a quote from Robert Earl Keene, and this one does too.
Let's talk about your love for Towns Van Zandt instead of Robert L. Keene, since we talked about him before.
I will have to say I'm not a huge Towns Van Zandt fan. I certainly like his music and his songwriting, but I am not a huge Towns Van Zandt fan. I'm much more of a Robert L. Keene fan. I'm much more, these days, Dale Watson. Do you know Dale?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I love Dale Watson.
He recorded an album here at Sun Studios a couple of years ago.
That's right. Yeah, he sure did.
He's got that great kind of baritone country
voice.
He's
the real deal. He's the real deal. We went to see him open at the Ryman for Old Crow Medicine Show. He's the real deal. And I have met him just a couple times. He wouldn't know me if he met me now, but I've talked to him. He's a delightful man. He's very humble.
His new album cover looks crazy, though. He looks really crazy on that new one.
His backstory is fascinating, too. I think, and I want to be careful about saying this, but I think he has had a bit of an outlaw past, not in the sort of general country music sense, but I think he has had some brushes with the law. And again, I'm not positive of that. I don't want to be real careful about saying that. But he is such a talented man and so focused on his music and a great guy to talk. Just we were at Bristol Rhythm and Roots, one of the music festivals, and ran into him. He's just nice and be.
And the lead singer of Ilk Road Medicine Show, his wife is a writer.
I didn't Ketch Secor?
Yeah, Ketch's wife is Lydia Peel. And she had a book of short stories come out a few years ago called Reasons for and Advantages of Breathing, which is one of my favorite books of all time.
I had no idea. Yeah.
And there's this bizarre thing in the New York Times about their marriage because they had a very kind of off and on again romance. And for some reason, the New York Times thought it was enough to do a story on. And so, like, there's this story.
It is their time. Right now is their time. I mean, it may be a little on the right-hand side of the bell curve for them, but this is their time. And they're deserving. They're great musicians. They're a high-energy band. They're fun to watch. They're fun to listen to. And I think it's difficult in music. I mean, some bands sound really good on the road live, and some bands are good in the studio. They are both. They're good musicians and they're a good live act. Their stuff translates well. We began watching them in small clubs and now big shows. So I really like them.
Are they originally from Virginia?
I have heard that Ketch Secor got his start. He and I think the other guy's name is Critter Fuqua. I think they got their start in Harrisonburg, Virginia. I think you're right, yeah. And then moved somewhere in the northeast, perhaps. But, yeah, I think he got his start there.
I was just thinking about a line from Pancho and Lefty. He wore his gun on the outside for the honest world to fear.
To fear, yeah, yeah.
And that's the opposite of the people they're dealing with in this book. They do not wear the gun on the outside.
The villains in this book, or the villain, is a pharmaceutical company, and more specifically, the head of the company, Seth Garrison. It's hard, I think, and you may have a better sense of this than I do, but it's hard to write. If you write that straight up and you write it kind of the way it is, it almost comes off as a cliche because I think everyone has a sense. There's a lot of greed in that business, and everyone has a sense, as I noted in the book, that we're really not about curing people, and we're really not about manufacturing medicine, and we're really not about pharmaceuticals. We're about profit. That's what we do. We satisfy our shareholders. Exxon is not about petroleum, it's about making money and making your shareholders happy. But it's so many people know that and so many people believe that, it is so hard, at least it was for me, to write a villain from a major corporate entity and have that villain not seem one-dimensional. So Seth Garrison has some quirks, some idiosyncrasies. He's a bit of a geek. He has some sort of speech tics. And I tried to make him a little outside the box in terms of villains. The scene on his boat, you know, I spent a lot of time talking about his dress, which he has all the money in the world, but he has sort of a clunky 80s haircut, and he is on a boat but wearing black socks. And so you try to do a few little things like that, no pun intended, to dress him up and make him different rather than just the one-dimensional, straightforward juggernaut of a bad guy.
And you really made me want a seafood omelet really badly.
Yeah, they have one on his boat, so yeah.
But, I mean, it's a really good one.
It sounded like it, you know, with the shrimp curling out of it.
Now, I'll have to say my favorite character in the book was the lawman Tolliver.
Oh, good.
He has such an ego. He was just a good time.
Loosely based on some folks I've known in the system. And a really good cop and a really good guy. And part of the whole deal, and I don't know how much readers or people who are not in the legal system understand this, there is an affection and a sort of give and take, especially in small towns, between defense lawyers and the really good cops. Especially, it's a generational thing. All the officers that I started with, I shouldn't say all, but a lot of them, we have this give and take, and it's the same give and take that he has with Joe Stone. Your job is to let the guilty go, and you're a doofus, and
bad lawyer jokes,
constant bad lawyer jokes. But there's a real affection, and I don't know because it's just one line and it's sort of a throwaway, but the first time Joe, or you meet Joe and Tolliver as a reader, Joe has done his divorce at a real discount for him. Basically, just you'll do it for cost as a courtesy, as a professional courtesy. And I don't know. I've never worked in Manhattan, and I've never worked in Memphis. But even in what I would call small, big cities like Roanoke, Virginia, near us, there's a good relationship, sort of a fun give and take between some of the defense lawyers. You're together all the time. You're in court. You'll get mad at each other. the professional wrestling kind of thing, and you're okay the next week. And I hope that comes through, and that's how that's written.
So do you think the chili at the Texas Tavern's overrated?
Yes, I absolutely do. My wife, Dina, and I have been there a couple times. They have a great book event in Roanoke. It's called the Roanoke Book and Author Dinner. The first book event I ever did, I opened for Frank McCourt. And a real quick aside, I ran into him the next morning. He was leaving, and I was just up rambling around, and I had breakfast with him. And he came as billed. He was a real raconteur. He was funny. He was acerbic. He was, and it was after Angela's Ashes, so I ate everything on my plate, ate every single morsel on my plate. And as he was leaving, he said to me, he said, "I think you're going to do well in this business. You've got a real future." And I said, "Oh, so you've read Many Aspects of Mobile Home Living," and I won't try to mimic the accent. He says, "Oh, you know, God, no." He said, "I read about 3 or 4 pages. It was absolutely pedestrian, and the title alone is enough to send me fleeing." He says, "But you're a lawyer, and you're all glib and agile, so you'll land on your feet and do well in this business, not that you're a particularly good writer." But in conjunction with that Roanoke Book and Author event, we often end up at the Texas Tavern, and I have never seen the attraction. Never. Now, there's some...
The burger is passable.
We've never had anything that we thought was over the moon good there. Maybe it's just us. And I know it's an institution, but it's not my cup of tea.
But I will say about Roanoke, every time I see the star, I smile. I always enjoy seeing the star.
I love Roanoke. And part of this book, of course, is set in Roanoke. And I think it's a great city. And once again, we live in a village. I mean, we live in a small town. Patrick County has 18,000 people. Stewart, the little county seat, I think has 800 people. So Roanoke is sort of our Mount Pilot to Mayberry. And it's a cool city. I like it.
And I'll have to disagree with Mr. McCourt. The Many Aspects of Mobile Home Living is one of my favorite books of all time.
Oh, well, thank you.
It is just hilarious and inventive and just downright weird.
Ah, well, thank you. Listening to it again for the first time on audio, like I say, I'd just completely forgotten about it. And it's been 15 years. I was happy with it. I laughed. Is that vainglorious to say that I laughed at my own stuff? It was cold to me. I hadn't heard it. And it was just fun. It is fun. I'm pleased that it held up well.
So why did you choose to listen to it?
Oh, because I wanted to hear the reader. I had never heard it. It had just been done. I mean, within the last 6 months, I'm trying to think of the reader's name. Henry Strozier, I think, is his name. And he does a lot of stuff for the Nature Channel. They sent me several samples, and this was the favorite. And I said, "You guys, you need to understand, this isn't King Lear. These guys are layabouts, like to drink. They like to smoke marijuana. And you need to get the right tone for this." And he did a knockout job. It's funny. He gets the voices. He is great. The sample I heard was what you might expect, a very good, profound sort of stage voice. But boy, did he do a good job. And I just loved it. So I'd never heard it. I wanted to hear what it sounded like. I'd never heard it before. And let's see how he did.
So you famously donated the proceeds of your first book to your local church to set up a child care program for working mothers. So have you gone back to give any more? I remember on that second book you said the first one was God, the second one was yours. What about number 4?
Just 20%. I will say that what we have been able to do since when did Many Aspects come out? In 2000. My father, when he passed away, left some of his estate basically to charity. We called it the Quiet Needs Fund, and it expanded to not only daycare, but what I call sort of the MacArthur grants for deserving people in Patrick County and that area. We call them wake-up checks. It's a small community so that we understand if you have an issue, a problem, if you've been laid off, you have medical issues. So what we've been able to do is send you a check, and you just wake up. It's in your P.O. box. And that was called the Quiet Needs Fund. So we combined that, and it is the entire charity now is a real, honest-to-goodness 501(c)(3) charity called the Martin Fillmore Clark Sr., named after my dad, Family Foundation. And we do a lot of good things through that, and that is funded by a lot of my book money.
So back to the professional front, you're an officer of the court.
That's true.
And in your books, there's a lot of application of extrajudicial justice going on.
That's true.
So how do your fellow lawyers and justices feel about that?
I am told, after reading Many Aspects of Mobile Home Living, our current Chief Justice, who is a good justice, a good lawyer, and a good guy, his name is Justice Lemons, Don Lemons. He has a real just brief cameo. And by the way, he had that cameo in this book before he became chief, so I'm not sucking up to him.
That New York accent is real?
That actually is another judge who's a friend. That judge, Dennis Klein in the book, is a combination of my friend Stan Klein and Dennis Smith. And yes, the New York accent is in fact real. But Justice Lemons told me that when our former Chief Justice, Justice Carrico, read many aspects of mobile home living, he was on the verge of bringing me to Richmond for a good stern talk. And according to Justice Lemons, he talked him out of it and saved my career. But people know me, and that's a good thing about working. I work in the 21st Judicial District. Everybody knows me. I mean, people have known me since I was a child. People are in court. People can see me. And you have a certain amount of protection and insulation because everybody knows what I'm doing, and they know how I'm cutting cases, how I'm deciding cases, if they're fair, if they're unfair. It's a fairly small bar, probably 70 lawyers. So everyone knows it's fiction, that I'm not rigging the game in any way for anyone.
Now, before the interview started, I was talking with your wife, Dina, and she said that the traveling's getting a little tough.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure this is a farewell tour. this is it. It really is. Now, part of it is my fault because we started in Nashville and my wonderful Pulitzer Prize-winning editor, Gary Fiskejohn, lives there. So I did the book event at Parnassus, and that was my first trip there. It's a great store. And after that, we had a party. We have an hour time difference, and at age 55, that goes into calculus. So I was a little tired. Then we ended up in Oxford for the next day. We were talking earlier about Lisa Howarth and Flying Shoes, her novel. And Richard and Lisa and I are really good friends and have been for a long time. Ace Atkins showed up, Lee Durkee showed up, and then some other friends, and that was a long night. So by the time I get to Jackson, I'm a little tired. This is our last stop before Beale Street, and it'll probably be worse tomorrow.
You know what they say down in Oxford about their football games, right?
No.
We may not win the game, but we never lose the party.
Oh, we're all American tailgaters. I love Oxford. It's just a fun, vibrant city. And by the way, I mentioned Lee Durkee's name, and I ran into him at Oxford. I hadn't seen him in years, and we worked together in 2000. Lee Durkee, myself, Haven Kimmel, and Liz Strout were the opening acts for Larry Brown and Barry Hanna at the Eudora Welty Festival, and the consensus was that Lee, and I think it's probably still accurate, was the most talented of the four of us, of Liz, Haven, and myself. He had written a book called Rides of the Midway. And he just disappeared after that. And I was so delighted to see him and learn that he has a new book he has written. It's on submission now. So I'm really wishing him well. And it was just a treat to see him. He had just sort of fallen off the face of the earth. Good to see him back. And he's a talented writer, so folks have something to look forward to.
And when can we look forward to the next one from Martin?
It's in my head about 75% intact, and I have made some notes. It will be quicker, I promise you, than 7 years. I've got about 3 more years left on the day job. I don't know if that will pick up my pace or not. I sort of have I try to write a page or two a day, and I don't think that'll change, even if I'm not getting up to go to work. I'm not sure how much difference it'll make, but my first book was 2000, then 2004, 2008, and 2015, you know, 3 or 4 years, I hope.
I know I pestered you for a little while there in the middle of when the book was coming out on your Facebook page. I would post something.
I was happy to see it. I was glad that at least one person was concerned or had an interest, so thanks for writing.
And I finally decided, I'm just slowing them down, so I'll leave them alone.
That's time I could spend writing when I'm replying to you.
So I'm not going to pester you at all for the next one, so let's see if we can get that a little bit earlier.
Well, 2 years, send me something, and I'll let you know where I am.
Thanks so much for stopping by, Martin.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Martin Clark is the author of The Jezebel Remedy, which is published by Knopf. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.